supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll address the burning topic of does peanut butter kill birds, and can rice thrown at a wedding really make them explode? We'll also talk about the fungi in your landscape in a fascinating interview with Dr. Karen Snetzlar, a professor at St. Joe's University, who teaches classes for the Wagner Free Institute of Science. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too, Steve. Where is Steve still celebrating the New Year?
In Maple Glen, Upper Dublin Township. In Pennsylvania.
All right. What can we do for Steve in Maple Glen? What a nice horticultural-sounding place.
My wife and I recently moved into a 200-year-old-plus rehabbed barn with a few acres attached to it. I've always wanted to do, and I have always wanted to put a vegetable garden in.
Okay.
And attached to the barn are a few acres with really untouched soil, I'm imagining. I think back in the day, there was livestock on it.
Mm-hmm.
And to now, it basically, it really gets cut by a tractor about three times a year. And I've always heard about the raised beds and wondering if that's the best way for me to go as far as planting the vegetables. Or should I just till out onto the field, which gets wonderful sun all day, and just use the earth that's there? Or should I build the frames and raise it up and go that route?
Should you attempt your first garden to be a flat earth garden, you will find out why this was even a poor idea back in the 18th century, especially if you are transforming what sounds like a hay field into your garden. Flat earth gardens have no advantages. They drowned in floods. They're overwhelmed with weeds, and especially with running weeds, weeds like grass and hay that migrate into the beds. You definitely will get more weeds than wanted plants. Basically, what you want to do is you want to assemble what some people would even call boxes that are 4 foot wide, and they can be as long as you want. Most people make them 8 foot because that's standard lengths of lumber. It also is real easy to work in. No wider than 4 feet, because once we make these things and fill them, we're not going to step into them again. The whole
okay.
concept of raised beds is you will never compress the soil so that you never need to till the soil. The soil will always stay light and fluffy and well-draining. And because it's raised about a foot above the surrounding area, grassy weeds just can't walk in. They stop at the edge of the raised beds. And should we get some of the devastating kind of rainstorms that we have the last couple of summers, and, you know, water just rushes around like small rivers, your raised bed, they have their heads above the water. So where other gardens get washed out, yours is fine. In a situation like yours, what I recommend is you scalp the grass in your garden area repeatedly a couple of times, and then over the entire area you wish to transform the first year. Remember, you can build a couple of beds a year instead of like trying to make a little farm. You can start with maybe three or four and then keep adding on as you understand the benefits. Cover the entire area with a single layer of cardboard. And then drop the raised beds on top of the cardboard. And then fill them up with a combination of real good screened topsoil. Real good topsoil means it's black when it's dry. And a good amount of compost. You know, typically half topsoil, half compost. But I also, more and more as I've gotten older, I like to mix in a lot of perlite. That's a natural mined mineral that's popped in big ovens. It looks like little styrofoam balls. You see it in seed starting mixes and when you buy your six packs at a garden center.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And it keeps the soil light and fluffy. So 4 feet wide beds, you can make them as long as you want. Make sure you have 2 feet of walking lanes in between the beds. In the walking lanes, you can put down wood chips to keep the weeds down, although you don't even have to. Some people just weed whack the walking lanes. But it sounds like you've got a perfect site. You start out with these raised beds, and the words of the great John Jevons, who was one of the early proponents of this, you grow twice as much in half the space with a quarter of the work.
Wonderful.
You have a great adventure ahead of you. I predict much success.
Thank you again.
All right, Steve. Take care, man.
All right, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Lauren, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Lauren. Where are you?
I am in Ringo's, New Jersey.
What can we do for Lauren and Ringo's?
I'm actually calling in response to a call you got earlier in the week from a woman who had her property trampled by a contractor, and she was asking about lawn establishment or seeding or mulching in the wintertime.
Right.
And I just wanted to mention, depending on the amount of area that the contractor had damaged, that he may be required by law to reestablish some sort of either vegetative cover or even in the winter, a mulch cover just for soil erosion and sediment control. So that's something that she may want to look into as far as requirements by the contractor to take care of.
Now, so you know this from your experience? Are you a real estate lawyer?
I'm a landscape architect, and I work for a firm that specializes in natural resource management. So we do quite a bit of work with dirt. And there are certainly permits that are required in both New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and most states for soil erosion and sediment control over 5,000 square feet of disturbance.
Excellent. So you're a primary source here. So you know for a fact that this is in New Jersey, and you think there are similar laws in most, if not all, states?
That's true. I know Pennsylvania also has a soil erosion sediment control requirement, and they actually are more stringent than New Jersey. The law states that you need a permit over 5,000 square feet, but even under 5,000 square feet, Pennsylvania requires that you have erosion control measures in place. So while they can't come out and specifically ask you for a plan on site from the contractor, you are required and expected by the state to stabilize soils that have been disturbed for any project.
And you said you're a landscape architect.
I am.
All right, let me throw this ball at you, Lauren, and let's say that there's no way around it. We have to finish this construction project. It's going to take us into, let's say, December, when all bets for any kind of germination are off. And just try to pick an average landscape in your mind. I realize all landscapes are different. We have to worry about where the water sources are and everything like that. But obviously, they can't germinate any grass seed at that time of year. There's no sod available. What would be your best idea for controlling soil erosion in that kind of circumstance? Because it happens all the time.
Well, certainly, you would want to rely on, and most contractors rely on, a mulch of straw. And then, ideally, they would use a tackifier to hold it in place, or they could crimp it with special crimping machines that would force parts of it into the soil to hold it into place. Most contractors don't realize that they're on the hook to keep that mulch there all through the season until permanent vegetative cover is in place. And so, you know, these are things that as a homeowner, it's handy to understand what your rights are, that your contractor is, in fact, required to keep, you know, a temporary cover over the winter before vegetation can grow, and that they should be monitoring the establishment of the permanent vegetation once the vegetation can germinate and grow.
And this should be part of the initial bid, right? This should be part of the estimate and everything.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly if you understand the area of disturbance, and you know, in both New Jersey and Pennsylvania, it's a 5,000 square foot disturbance threshold over which you need to apply for the permit. There would be permit fees involved, and also the assembly of a plan set that would show the construction sequence and the areas of disturbance and the measures taken to manage that disturbance, including things like silt fence and what seed mixes you would use and things like that.
And at the end of the day, not only does this prevent the mud pit that our listener was worried about, but it's going to help our small waterways.
That's exactly where these laws rose out of. Clean Water Concerns, the Clean Water Act, was not directly involved in the initiation of soil erosion sediment control acts, but it certainly, you know, clean streams and protecting soil resources, definitely important.
Lauren, I got to thank you so much. I promise that I will not forget this.
Yeah.
And I thank you for bringing it to our attention. Real good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day and great job on the show.
Thank you. You too, Nell.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and alert you to call all of your fungi friends and mushroom mavens and tell them that immediately upon our return, Professor Karen Snetzlar from St. Joseph's University will enthrall us with fascinating facts about stinkhorns, puffballs, fairy rings, and the other fabulous fungi that thrive above, below, and alongside our featured flora. But don't talk to them too long because we're going to be right back with those fungi, whether peanut butter is bad for birds, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Hollytone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we are always telling you to feed birds in the winter so that those birds will stay around and eat your bad bugs for you in the summer. But are all foods created equal? There are stories going around that peanut butter gags birds and that rice thrown at weddings causes them to explode. Is this true? Could it possibly be? We'll tell you when we get to the question of the week. We're also going to take more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to talk with our special guest, Professor Karen Snetzlar from St. Joseph's University. Dr. Snetzlar is teaching another of her wonderful free courses at the Wagner Free Institute of Science. But the class is filled up. These are very popular classes. So we're going to get get Dr. Snetzlar to give us the course in a brief time on the radio. Karen, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
It's great to be here.
In my mind, there are three aspects of fungi in the garden that our listeners are mostly interested in. And the most obvious one are the mushrooms. And you're going to talk about some of our favorites, right? The famous dog vomit fungus, the stinkhorn mushrooms, the triple X rated fungus. Will you be discussing the artillery fungus that breeds in wood mulch?
So the artillery fungus, again, with a great name, these all have such wonderful names, certainly is not as spectacular as a stinkhorns, but maybe does actually cause more problems than some of the others. I think oftentimes these fungi are more feared than they need to be, but perhaps the artillery fungus is worth being a little bit concerned about.
Most people never see the, I guess you'd call it the fruiting organism or whatever, but it shoots little spores at light-colored objects, and it loves the sides of white vinyl houses. And these spores can travel 30 feet. And we had a video on our website a while ago, maybe we can find it again, that shows these things going off, and they look like the old artillery on a naval craft.
They do have amazing mechanisms for shooting those little spore packets as far as they do. A number of fungi do that, and it's pretty cool because they actually can see the light. They have like a little lens, so they really almost have an eye that allows them to shoot those spores towards something light.
And people never relate it to the wood mulch that they have piled around their house.
Until they try to find out what's going on, they may not realize that that's the source of the fungus, is that wood mulch. And
one of the jobs of fungal organisms is to break down dead wood and turn it into soil.
That's right. So it shouldn't be a surprise that these mulches are filled with fungi. And as you know, I'm not a big fan of mulch anyway. So maybe the thing to do is think about not putting it right next to the building, maybe a ground cover or something like that, because it is going to break down.
And that's the hard thing for people to wrap their head around when the we call it a stinkhorn fungus because we can't call it the other names that people call it. But it is it is 8 inches, a foot tall, these red shoots, let's call them, that come up out of the mulch, and they're very embarrassing looking. And then when people start to like kick them or pull them up or hoe them down, they find out why they're called stinkhorns.
They do have a bad smell, and of course that smell is very adaptive for them because they're attracting flies.
Now, let me stop you there because I know certain flowers give off smells like a rotting carcass to attract flies, but why would a fungal organism want a fly?
Well, for the same reason. They don't have seeds or pollen, but they do have spores. And so these flies will get covered with the spores, and then they fly off. They drop the spores somewhere, and the fungus has got a new place to grow.
Now, one thing that does pop up that doesn't necessarily have to be related to rotting wood, either underground or on the surface, are fairy rings.
Oh, yeah. They're so pretty. Who wouldn't want a fairy ring in their lawn? So fairy rings are mushrooms, typically, that will be in a circle. And the idea is, in the very center of that circle, at some point, there was a single spore that started to grow. And every year it gets bigger. It grows out just like a culture on a petri dish, although much larger, of course. And it produces mushrooms at the edge of that colony every year.
But what do you propose would be the reason for the concentric circle?
Well, because it starts from a central point and the filaments grow the same speed as they're growing out. It's just looking for food. And so generally the food's going to be the same all the way around. So they just keep growing, getting bigger and bigger.
And then why do they come up?
Well, at the end of the year, they sporulate if they've had enough to eat. If it was a good year, then they'll go ahead and make the mushrooms that produce the spores that are then blown away on the wind or carried by some animal to start another fairy ring in your neighbor's lawn.
Our lawn care expert, Nick Christians, told me they were actually good for lawns.
Well, that's good. I'm glad they're saying that because the turf people haven't always felt that way.
And I think most people think of mushrooms in two ways. They know edible mushrooms, and the edible mushrooms, especially today, that are felt to have very powerful, beneficial, health-enhancing properties, things like shiitake mushrooms, more so than the white button mushrooms.
Sure.
And they know the edible mushrooms. They also know that if they get clever and decide that they're going to figure out which one's growing wild or edible or not, they They may wake up dead the next morning. They know that mushrooms can be very toxic. But I don't think people realize this incredible underground life, without which I'm almost hearing from you, maybe this wouldn't be as green a planet.
Well, it might be very green for a while, but then there wouldn't be anything to break down the dead stuff. So it would be a very brown planet without mushrooms to decompose everything so that we could start it all over again, certainly.
So mushrooms are soil builders.
They're soil builders. They're part of the soil, but they also break down the complex materials that come from plants and animals that die and return them to simple things that new plants and animals can use.
When I was young and energetic and kind of really just starting gardening in the first house we really owned, we were about 5 years into it, and I was in the woods near the house and found this incredible log that had literally 30 different things that I could identify growing on it, moss and like brightly colored lichens and different mushrooms coming out of it. And it took me a day and a half to drag this beast. And, you know, I got it back into the front of the house, and I'm thinking, okay, smart guy, what's the rest of this plan? And I had a garden bed that I was going to plant with annual flowers, and instead I just dropped this log into the center of it. And it cascaded through the season. I mean, yeah. It constantly replanted itself.
It's amazing. You know, and kids are fascinated by that, too. We sometimes go to programs where we'll take something natural to try and attract children. And there's a rotting log kit you can get that has a few bugs in it. We've gotten kids away.
It's like the old Saturday Night Live routine, bag of glass. What do you mean a rotting log kit?
A rotting log. I've pulled kids away from wrappers to look at a rotting log, look at a beetle coming off a log. They love it. But it is really fun. In my yard this year, we have a very small yard. We had three mature trees, and we've lost them all to disease or being planted on top of the sewer line. But we're going to leave the stump and watch what happens as it rots. I've already gotten a lion's mane fungus that we could eat.
Oh, that's great.
So it was really fun.
And you're smart enough to do that.
Well, that's one of the easy ones for sure. So I definitely don't recommend eating mushrooms out of your yard unless you really know what they are.
There are old mushroom hunters, right, and there are bold mushroom hunters, but there are no old, bold mushroom hunters.
Yeah, that's right. You really want to know. And there are local chapters of the North American Mycological Association. There are, I think, 5 in Pennsylvania, and many states have multiple societies. So you can find people that can help you if you really want to eat mushrooms.
One thing that I want our listeners to take away from this, of course, you can never warn them enough about the stuff that's going to pop up out of their wood mulch. And the part they have the hardest time wrapping their head around is there's nothing wrong. This is nature in action. You should have expected this if you knew your biology.
That's right. Mulch is breaking down. That's what it does. It's being decomposed. And so there will be.
And it can't do it by itself.
No, there are microbes that do that. And it's mostly fungi because they're aerobic. There are some bacteria
as
well.
See, we don't know that. We figure everything rots. It just does. And we attribute it to rain and sun and wind. And instead, it's billions of tiny organisms converting the material.
Right. And they're interesting and beautiful as well. They're not really fungi, but they look like fungi. They're little slime molds. It really takes just a magnifying glass to be able to see the beauty that's there. And so you can really get into it, and it becomes then not upsetting, but just kind of fun to watch.
Every mycologist I've ever met, and I've met more of them than most people would believe, loves their slime molds.
They are amazing.
This is why people wouldn't talk to you in grad school. I mean, you know, yeah. Hey, you want to come see my slime mold?
Nobody wants to go hiking with the mycologist because we stop and look at everything for a very long time. And the slime mold people are the worst because they are quite small. But there are paintings that have been done of these tiny little sporing structures. They look like little jewels. They're beautiful.
And they just appear, right?
They just appear. A lot of them on wood. A lot of them will appear on rotting wood. So it is a great idea to leave that log there and just let it break down.
And in the meantime, up people who want to learn more about this, what's the resource you would turn them on to?
For fungi, there are many resources, many of them on the internet. Penn State, for example, or any of the land-grant institutions will typically have some good resources.
And we'll list some of those resources at our website. Well, thank you for spending this time with us again. Professor Karen Snetzlar from St. Joseph's University will be teaching a sold-out class for the Wagner Free Institute of Science. So we won't give you all the details just to get you upset, but we hope you got a little piece of the action from our interview today. Thanks for coming in to You Bet Your Garden.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Don, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, a pleasure to speak with you.
A pleasure to speak with you, Don. Where are you, sir?
I am in Parrish, Florida, which is about 30 miles southeast of Tampa.
And you're not enjoying any kind of ice dams on your roof, any sledding, any treacherous sidewalks in wintertime?
No, just some nice kayaking and fishing and harvesting my tomatoes.
I tell you, these northeast winters are getting to me. Florida's looking better all the time. What can we do for Don down in a tiny little corner of paradise?
I have one major problem with my vegetable garden. I grow organically in raised beds, and after my first year here, I quickly discovered my nemesis, which is the southern root knot nematode.
Let me stop you right there, because this is something that northerners don't understand, but that I learned about when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine. In most parts of the country, there's a couple of pest nematodes of things like boxwoods, kind of rare occurrences. But mostly, we use a different species of nematode beneficially to water into lawns, especially because they are parasites of beetle grubs in lawns. But your southern root knot nematode is a notorious and tenacious pest. Their favorite crop is tomatoes, and you know that it was the nematodes that killed your tomatoes because, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you pull up the bodies, they've got all these, quote, knots around their roots.
Oh, it's just a twisted mass of knots. You're not thinking maybe. You know when you see the roots of a tomato plant that's been infected. I listened to a show you did last summer where a caller from Florida had a similar problem with her tomatoes, and you suggested French marigolds.
Right.
And I did French marigolds, and they have helped.
Did you do what I said, which was to grow them to flowering size and then plow them into your soil?
Absolutely. I grew a nice, healthy crop of marigolds, and when it came time to plant, I cut them off at ground line. I actually used my leaf shredder to shred them up and put that back on the bed and worked them in.
Okay. And you're saying you got some success?
I had some success. I had one of my tomato plants die recently, and I pulled it out of the ground, and the roots were fine. So
okay.
But my pole beans, on the other hand, which they also bother, they looked like they were infected by root knot nematodes.
And again, this was in soil that you had, quote, treated by growing the marigolds.
Right. They were in different raised beds. I have four raised beds. But the one with the pole beans in them, yeah, the beans died, and it was sure looked like nematodes to me.
It's pretty distinctive, Don, and I trust your judgment here. Although the interesting thing, you know, with peas and beans, they're legumes. And when you plant your beans, did you use a soil inoculant?
Yes, I did.
Okay, because you know that this beneficial bacteria that you mix into the soil when you plant peas and beans that allows them to take plant food from the air, that causes growths on the root.
I've seen those before. And I grew my pole beans up north before I grew them down here, and I used the inoculant, and I've seen what they look like. And I'm not positive it was nematodes, but I think it was.
Okay. So there's another thing that's very easy for you to do because you're in Florida, and that's solarize your soil. Have you ever tried anything like that?
The first year I was here, I tried it, and I think I did it wrong.
Okay. So to solarize your soil, you till the soil up really well, and then you level it. and then you saturate it with water, literally, until the soil cannot hold water any longer. And when you reach that point, you stretch clear plastic over the top of the soil, doing this right as you're getting into the hottest part of your season. I'm going to say June. Stretch it really tight and anchor it down at the sides and clear plastic and then let it cook. In the north, if you're going to do this, you need a hot summer to help you out and everything like that. But in a climate like yours, I would figure 2 months would be enough to completely kill every nematode and every soil-borne disease in your soil. And for some reason that researchers don't understand, instead of really, quote, sterilizing the soil, it just kills the bad things. And then the plants that follow it seem to thrive better than plants in non-solarized soil. So what I would suggest is marigolds in some beds and trisolarization in a couple of other beds. Do a little experiment, because really, okay, you're not going to be growing much during like July and August. So it's the ideal time to do some cooking.
Absolutely.
All right, Don?
Thank you, sir.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that this year's edition of the Fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show runs from February 28th through March 8th with a Celebrate the Movies theme. That membership in the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society includes tickets to the show, and that PHS memberships might just cost less than the price of the tickets you get. Hint, hint. But don't go searching for the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to investigate whether Peter Pan killed Cock Robin and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will address two burning issues of bird feeding. Does feeding peanut butter to wild birds harm them? And do they really explode if they eat the rice thrown at a wedding? We want to know the answers, and we'll deliver those answers after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. What a pleasure. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Thank you for making it. Where are you?
I am in West Cape May, New Jersey.
What can we do for Lynn in West Cape May?
I have a question about sod and a little bit of background. My husband and I have no prior experience with sod, so we want to make sure that we're doing the right thing to protect our investment in our lawn.
That's a very good idea. Sod is expensive, but if it's handled properly, you get an instant lawn that can be bulletproof as long as you care for it.
That's our goal. So in mid-November, we had sod installed on our front lawn, about 600 square feet. And then in mid-December, we had sod installed on our back lawn, about 1,800 square feet. So on both occasions, we heavily watered the lawn for about 10 days. The front still looks green and lush. However, the back has started to turn brown in the past week. And at present, it's approximately three-quarters green with a quarter of the lawn brown blades of grass that are evenly distributed throughout. So we're concerned that this brown is starting to creep into the sod in the back that was planted in mid-December. And we're wondering if we planted the sod too late in the season, and will it revive and become green again in the spring? Is there anything we can do to make sure that it does become green again in the spring?
Where did you even get sod in December?
Well, we purchased it from a very reputable local garden store that gets it from Upper Township in Cape May. So there's a sod farm at the top part of Cape May, and they supplied it to us.
And they cut it fresh and brought it to you in December?
Absolutely, and it was delivered the same day it was cut, and it was laid that day and the following day, so within 24 hours.
Okay. You made one mistake already that I've heard you say that might be more important than the timing, and that I wish we could put you in the TARDIS and take you back to November and go to our website, youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, and look under S for sod. Because none of it is intuitive. We interviewed Nick Christians, our lawn care expert from Iowa State University, for that article. And one thing Nick said, if I recall correctly, and I think I'm getting this right, is you do want to saturate the sod for the first 24 hours. But then you want to not water it again for a while because you don't want to drown it. One thing that is poorly understood, even plants that are alive and still growing in cold weather are growing much more slowly than they are when they're getting good photosynthesis and there's good air and soil temperatures. So your sod is alive and growing over the winter, but it can only use maybe one-tenth the amount of water that it can use during the summertime when the roots are growing. Now comes the million-dollar question. What was the sod composed of? Do you know the variety of grass?
I do not. I'm sorry.
Here's what's going on. If the sod is turf-type tall fescue, which is a very popular form of sod, that is a grass that if an area dies, it will need to be replaced. Now, if it's a variety of bluegrass, or it's a mix of bluegrass and fescue, the bluegrass is a running grass. The living grass will spread to fill in any bare spots.
Okay.
So let it get through the winter. In the spring, you'll be able to see if there's any dead spots. Then you have two options. You can either go to the sod farm or go through the nursery. You want to find out definitely what type of grass you have, because that's going to be important for the future.
Okay.
If it is a turf-type tall fescue, you will have areas that are going to die. I mean, things happen. You know, dogs tear up the grass, people tear up the grass, accidents happen. So you want them to supply you with some matching seed.
Okay.
And if there are any dead areas, you can either buy some sod, matching sod, and patch it. Although, if it is a turf-type tall fescue, you're going to want to know the name and the availability of the matching seed, because as the years progress, we normally have to overseed a turf-type tall fescue. But no matter what, you can fix it.
Thank you, Mike, so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck.
Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Ron. Where are you, man?
I'm up in Ambler, Pennsylvania. I have a question for you regarding my fig tree.
Excellent.
Well, there's a lot of neighbors around here and relatives who are absolute fig fanatics, and everybody seems to have their own way of pruning as to when they prune, how much they cut off, and I'm kind of stuck in the middle and totally befuddled because I'm not quite sure which way to go. Do I trim it in the fall?
No.
Or do I trim it in the springtime?
Yes.
I trim it in the springtime. All right, well.
Never in the fall. Goodbye, Ron. Thanks for calling. No.
Yeah, you're almost exactly right. Yeah.
My engineer is going, yes, the shortest call in the history of the show.
Well, no, I'm sure that you could go on for hours about this. But,
well, I'll go on for a couple of minutes. Now, do you protect the tree over winter at all?
I do. I wrap it in light, kind of like a tarpaulin type thing, no plastic, and then stuff it with mulched up leaves that I use for mulch later in the year on gardens and whatnot.
And how has this worked for you in previous years?
Well, I get tons of figs on it, but they don't seem to ripen.
Right, because you get a lot of winter kill.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, I get a whole lot of new growth. You know, I get tons of that, but
yes.
Then I get a whole bunch of figs on there, but they never seem to quite get to the point where they ripen.
Figs are Mediterranean plants. Their top growth is fairly sensitive to cold. Their roots are invulnerable to cold.
Mm-hmm.
So many figs that are unprotected, or when we get a treacherous winter like last year, they will die back to the ground, but they'll
right.
still regrow from their roots. However, mm-hmm. being Mediterranean plants, they're a long-season crop. So without protecting a lot of the top growth, they don't have time to fully mature. So the best bet is at the end of the season to mostly leave it alone. I understand what you're doing, filling the cage with shredded leaves and everything like that. That can work against you, too, because mice and voles can get in there and really eat away at the fig. But if you would notice that damage. You would notice.
Right. I haven't seen any of that.
Right. And I would want to make sure that your cover was breathable. But in the spring, when everything starts to come alive, take that cover off a little earlier than later.
You know,
figs are not that frost sensitive. It's like rosemary. You know, they can stay out a little bit later. They can go out a little bit earlier. It's the middle of winter that typically knocks them off.
I got you. Oh, would you say around April 15th or so?
I wouldn't know.
Planting time earlier than that?
Yeah. March 15th, April 1st. With attention paid to the weather. If it's going to drop down to 5, no.
Of course.
if we're having temps that are at least reliably in the even low 40s, that's absolutely fine.
Okay.
So take the cover off and then look at it. And as soon as it starts to grow its new growth for the season, look at it and get rid of any dead wood. Get rid of any wood that's not greening up.
Gotcha.
Keeping as much good material as possible. But if you do that, you should have enough time for the plant to put on enough biomass for this season, produce the figs early enough that they will have time to ripen at the end of the season.
That's great. That's great, Mike. Now, when should I expect to start seeing edible figs? Generally, is it around the end of September?
Well, you see, it's not a universal plant. There are different varieties of figs. Some varieties, if you live a little bit south of us, can produce two crops a summer.
Oh, wow.
And most fig trees were handed down. Most were cuttings from friends or neighbors
right.
or something. So their lineage is lost. But sometimes people do kind of get trapped because they have a tree that's very healthy. And, you know, the leaf structure is beautiful on figs.
Oh, yes.
They're amazing plants. But you might accidentally have a variety that is a very long season variety, where in Pennsylvania, you want a pretty short season variety. So if you do everything right and you have a lot of good wood at the end of the winter and you get good early growth and you're still not getting ripe figs, I would suggest you might want to buy a new plant that is designated for the north, because it sounds like you got everything else going for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this.
Yes, my pleasure, Ron. Figs are a hot topic on the show, so you've helped many people here.
That's great. Well, thank you again.
All right, take care, sir.
You too, sir. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Do peanut butter and wedding rice really hurt birds? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started on this week's topic, please.
So you got in trouble again recently.
I was born in trouble.
A few weeks ago, you repeated some advice about what to do with your leftover cut Christmas tree. You said to either prune off the branches and use them to protect pansies over winter and to mulch azaleas and rhododendrons, or, and I quote, stand the tree up in your backyard and cover it with suet feeders and big globs of peanut butter to create the most natural bird feeder imaginable.
Yeah, sure. I don't remember who I originally stole that idea from, but people have always loved it. It's a great wintertime activity for kids, and the tree provides protection and shelter for the birds, which you don't get with regular feeders or even suet feeders on deciduous trees.
But then Kathy in Mount Rainier, Maryland wrote, don't use your old Christmas tree as a bird feeder by spreading peanut butter on the needles. Peanut butter can gag birds and they die. Peanut butter is not a natural food for birds.
And your point?
You are so rude.
And your point? Anyway, actually her email did have me worried. I picked that tip up from another source a really long time ago. And what if they were wrong and she's right? I don't want to be killing any birds.
Well, what happens to your birds when you do this?
Are you kidding me? Do you know how much organic peanut butter costs? I love my birdies, but I could buy 5 suet cakes for the price of a jar of creamy smooth. Now, I really wanted to find out what was going on, so I started to research this, and I immediately fell into a swamp. It's not really addressed in any primary sources. The closest I could come was an Audubon Society Kids Craft Project online that said make a bird feeder using pine cones, peanut butter with cornmeal, and bird seed. Their only warning was about not doing this with kids with peanut allergies. Most articles that addressed any potential bird danger treated it like a hoax or an old wives' tale kind of thing. But very few of those brush-offs actually quoted any kind of researcher or expert. Now, a big exception, and one of the best articles I found, was at a website called familycorner.com. It was written by Amanda Formaro, a crafting guru with a very impressive resume and 3 websites of her own. She quotes 2 excellent primary sources, an Audubon Society refuge manager who said there's just no risk, and the editor of the magazine Birdwatchers Digest, who agrees with that, but says it can't hurt to mix in some whole oats, some cornmeal, and some raisins to make the peanut butter less sticky. Now, the vast majority of people with real birding knowledge seem to echo those words. There's no known danger, but it can't hurt to mix in some grit to make the peanut butter less sticky.
Grit?
Yeah, a word that refers to something I probably have way too much of, a family newspaper published in Williamsport, PA, and a substance some birds eat to improve their digestion, things like sand and finely crushed eggshells. The grit of choice for peanut butter and pine cone projects seems to be cornmeal. It was everywhere. A Cornell University website that Amanda's article referenced pretty much puts it the same way everybody does. There's no documented evidence of any harm. However, mixing the peanut butter with grit or cornmeal will break up any stickiness if you're concerned.
But it sounds to me that there really isn't a cause for concern.
Well, that was my first conclusion, but I kept digging. With me, research is limited only by deadlines, not common sense or time management. And so I finally found an article at the University of Illinois Extension that mostly quoted experts who repeated the standard, "We've never seen any proof of this." But they also included the story of a woman who had been a volunteer at a place called the Willowbrook Nature Center in DuPage County in Illinois. She recounted that several years before, quote, about 10 dead birds were brought to the center with peanut butter in their beaks or gullets, which was enough for the center's vet to say that we should probably tell people to put some grit in it or don't use peanut butter at all.
Oh, my. And so...
So now I'm a grit man. Although with peanut butter being so expensive, I think I'm just going to focus on suet feeders on Christmas trees from now on. They're a great high-energy food for birds in the winter and have never been a source of controversy. Same for mealworms.
Mealworms?
You're a vegetarian, right? Don't ask.
I guess you didn't have time to research the other concern about birds exploding after they eat rice thrown at weddings?
Isn't that a great image? But that one is easy. It's a total myth. Rice is a grain which birds naturally eat. In fact, some birds are a serious problem in rice fields. So no explosions. It's even on Snopes. Well, that sure was some interesting information about bird feeding myths and realities, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to stuff me in a pine cone if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore. As long as you include your location in that email at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's web page wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our avian editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, previously believed the exploding bird theory. Our production assistant, Peter Christian, he looks like he needs to eat some more peanut butter. I wouldn't put it past our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, to eat peanut butter out of a pine cone. I'm investigative Mike McGrath, and I'll report more rumors behind the news when I see you again next week. Is there anything weirder than America's native marsupial? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss whether danger or benefit lurks behind the beady eyes of opossums. Plus, fighting fire ants and answers to all your growing questions.